This is a great pleasure for me. As many of you that have been here for a while in school have known that we've been praying for some period of time for just such an opportunity. And especially among the young people who I've had the opportunity to be with in these past few years here at the school or out on choir tour, and many times we've prayed together for God to meet a specific need, and that is the deliverance of our POWs and bring them home. And I'm happy tonight that this is my pleasure and my privilege. Now, Colonel Reisner, as I'll call him to you, I know him by several other names. Entered the service 30 years ago. He was real young then. And entered during the Second World War, served during that period of time, returned again on call to active duty during Korean conflict, became one of the nation's jet aces at that time, continued serving our country in many areas, moved into the Vietnam conflict, was shot down, and was rescued, and was returned to active duty immediately, and then in September of 65, was shot down, and consequently spent 7.5 years as a prisoner of the North Vietnamese. And many of you have followed the subsequent release of he and the other men from the prisoner of war camp, February. And since that time, God's blessing on their lives, and what a privilege and a pleasure to have him here tonight to share with you the testimony of what God not only can do, but did do during very trying times. It's my pleasure to introduce Colonel Reisner.
Tonight, this is sort of a fulfillment of a dream of mine. I had a lot of dreams while I was in prison, and one of my dreams was of standing here in CBC. Although I had been here only as a visitor a long time ago, I know quite a bit about your school because two of my brothers and one of my sisters went through here. And I'm happy to say they all graduated. And then I have various nephews and nieces that have gone through or are still going here. Hopefully, it would be a very wonderful thing if some of my own children, and I have 5 sons, would choose to become a minister. I want to say this tonight, and I mean it in all sincerity, that to me the highest calling, higher than presidency, to be a king, or anything else, the highest calling, the calling for which I have the most admiration, the most respect, to me the highest calling of all is a minister of God. I felt that way a long time. And when I was your age and a little younger, I was searching my own heart to see what I was to do in life. And I used to talk to God about it. I used to tell him all the reasons why I was not equipped, why I was not capable of being a minister. And I had a lot of reasons, a lot of good ones, I thought. But I think God chose to send me a different route. And isn't it wonderful to know that God has the patience and the love to wait as many years as is necessary to really claim his own? And I feel that's what he's done for me. I've been a Christian a lot of years, but had never really said, okay, God, whatever you say. Not really in my heart until after I had been a prisoner a couple of years in North Vietnam. I really had to know that I meant it and that I could stick by it. I could fulfill my word to God. When I finally came to that decision, I knew I had finally made it. And I intend to stick by that, whatever God has for me to do. So I feel that it's in God's plan for me to be here tonight, and I'm so very thankful. It's a great honor to talk to you tonight. You are very special people to me. All of you young folks that are studying for the ministry. It's such a wonderful time of life. Maybe I can deviate for just a moment and give you my thoughts on America. Do you realize, I'm sure you probably do, but not everyone does, that this is probably the most exciting, exhilarating age that we have ever known? Can you remember for a moment all of the progress that has been made in communications, automation, aviation, computerization, space? Do you know that almost as much, if not as much, has happened in the past this century as happened in all previous history? You think about it. Think of the progress that has been made. Man has only been able to communicate effectively to the masses in writing for the last 250 years. There's so much that has happened and is happening now. It's such a wonderful time in which to live. I'm so thankful that God permitted me to live now and to raise my children in this time. Yes, there are problems. There are social ills. But my, I'm so glad that I have the confidence in America and in the young people that will eventually run our country to know that we not only have the desire, but the capability to cure those ills. I am not discouraged in the least. I was asked when I came back by various correspondents if I was not shook by all the social changes. No, I'm not shook. I realize that this is a time of rapid changes. As long as we change what is wrong, as long as we make changes for the better and just don't make changes to be making changes, we're going to make a lot of progress, and the good old United States of America is just going to get better every day. It's a wonderful, wonderful privilege to be back in the land of the free and the home of the brave, and you never really know how much you have until you've lost it. I now am able to see the red, white, and blue in so many other places I never saw it before. And when they play the Star Spangled Banner, well, God bless America, it stops me in whatever I'm doing. You see, I missed the music, and I missed those words, and I missed hearing the sermons. I missed touching that wonderful Bible. I missed the ability to walk in and out of a door when I wanted to. I missed it so much, more than I can ever express. And now I have it back. And I want with all of my heart to help preserve it. And I want to perpetuate it. It really saddens me to think of anyone that would disgrace our flag or our country or our God. That's the only things. Those are the things that distresses me. I'm not distressed by the problems. Or let me say, I'm not discouraged. Well, I want to tell you a little bit about God in the prison. You know about God in America, and you know about God in CBC, and you know about God in the surrounding churches. Let me tell you about God in communist prison in North Vietnam. When I was shot down the second time, the first time I was shot down over North Vietnam, and despite the fact my plane was on fire, and my engine was quitting, and it was winding down. I could hear it slowing down like a car that's run out of gas and is coasting to a stop. And they were hollering, "You're on fire." But I made it to the water before my airplane went out of control, and when I ejected at low altitude, I was upside down. Despite this, everything worked just as it's supposed to work, and the chute opened. I only got a cut lip out of it, and I was in the water just that long. And I was back in my life raft. They picked me up in a few minutes, and I was back flying the next day. Well, I wasn't so fortunate the second time. God had other plans. And I remember when the chute opened. Again, I was flying right on the deck, and I used some of the slang, if you don't mind. I was flying right on the treetops, or right down in the grass, as some would say, at about 600 miles an hour. And we were looking for a strategic, for a surface-to-air missile site that we thought we had located. And there was a small hill just in front of me, just about as high as the ceiling, and I had to pull up to go over it. And just as I pulled up, the tracers were coming down both sides of the fuselage. And they look about this big, and they're glowing red. They look like big red tennis balls, only they're not. And they were coming down both sides, and they evidently had seen me before I even raised up over the hill, and they were firing. I just raised up, and I went right into this hail of automatic weapons fire, and it ran some of them right down my intake, and the engine just kind of gave up the ghost, you know, and it shuddered. I hit the, what we call the, there's a switch over here, there's a little red button, and it says jettison all. That means when you hit that, you really have problems, and you're going to get rid of everything on the bottom of the airplane, gas, your fuel tanks, and all of your bombs and so forth. That's what we call the panic button. I reached over and hit the panic button and went to afterburner, which is, gives you twice as much power. And I couldn't see anything because of the smoke and fire in the cockpit. And just a couple of seconds later, the airplane pitched forward. The stick, the control stick, came back in my lap. I was out of control, and I was thrown against the canopy. Well, I ejected successfully. And as soon as the parachute opened, in my heart, I said, I guess this is the Lord's answer. He's got other things for me to learn. As I hit the ground on the side of a dike, I pulled the ligaments and the tendons in my right knee. As I jumped up to run, I was heading for a hilltop so that the helicopter might have a chance to come in and get me, and the gunfire was something tremendous. They were shooting at my wingman. As I fell and tumbled, I jumped up to run, and I was jerked back again like a tethered goat. I had tangled, when I pulled out my emergency radio to talk to my wingman, I was hollering at him to get out over the water because I was sure they were going to shoot him down. And when I stuck it back in there, I had tangled it, and it was wrapped around my parachute. So when I jumped up to run, it jerked me down again, and I could hear the people coming from all the sides, and the rice was about chest tall, and so I was out of sight. But they had seen where I'd gone down. I grabbed my pistol. As I grabbed my pistol and put it in my left hand, I grabbed my knife in my right to cut myself loose, and I couldn't get the knife out. Everything seemed to go wrong. The knife was in the sewed to the back of my G-suit in a scabbard, and besides that, I'd had a piece of parachute cord, which is very, very strong, around the handle and tied around my leg to keep it from coming out when I ejected, if I did. And it was tied in a knot, and I couldn't get the knife out. So in my urgency, I ran the tip of the knife through the scabbard into the calf of my leg, and I thought, everything is going wrong. And then I could hear the people quite close, and all of a sudden I heard someone was right on top of me, and I just switched hands with my pistol. It was a beautiful combat masterpiece, and it was fairly new, and I had just fired it in. I had test fired it on a test range. I knew exactly where it shot, and I'd had the trigger sear file down so that it was very light, just like a feather. And I had told everyone in the squadron, we've talked about it a lot of times, and I said, I'll never be captured. You know, it's going to be worse than death, and I just don't want that. I'd rather be killed fighting. And I really meant that. And as I raised up, and I just had my pistol cocked, I looked right down a rifle bore. It was just a step away. And this thought flashed through my mind. Remember what you told him? But my pistol was not even aimed at him, and I thought, and while it was just a fragment of a second, he just took his hand off. Right hand was still on the trigger, and he took his left hand off and just went. And as he did, I looked around, and they had me covered from everywhere. And why they didn't shoot me, I don't know. So, to make a very long story short, I dropped my pistol and ground it into the mud. They captured me. As they were tying my hands behind me, they had me on my knees, and they were stripping of my equipment. I saw a one-eyed civilian. They had a lot of militia, civilian military that had surrounded me. And a militiaman, or rather a civilian, one-eyed, had reached down in the mud and searched around, and he found my pistol. And as he got up, and I was on my knees, he put this between right here in my forehead, and he was shaking. And of course, he had heard many awful tales about the Americans. They taught him that We always, or to our prisoners, we slit them open, took their livers, we ate their livers. And I guess he thought I was going to perform some horrible magic. And he was very scared, and the sweat was running down, and he was white and shaking, and this gun was against my forehead, and I thought as I looked him right in the one good eye, I wonder how much trigger pull that's going to take. Because I had filed it down. And as he, I remember looking in the mud, and the water was dripping off the corner of his finger and off of his hand. And I wondered if I would see his finger turn white before, you know, I'd read all these fiction tales. And I wondered if I would see his finger turn white before he pulled the trigger. And then the thought flashed through my mind, you're not sure. I knew for positive, beyond any doubt, that God had plans for me. He had work that I had not yet done. And so from that moment on, I never had any doubt that I would be back. And I would be back in such condition that I could do whatever God had me to do, for me to do. So I was never surprised. And I've been asked, did you ever lose hope? No, I never lost hope. Many times I was desperate. I didn't know if I could make it with my sanity. But I never, never thought that I was not coming back. God did some wonderful things there, not only for me, but for some of the other guys. There are things that happened there that we don't understand. A Captain Ron Stortz was 6'4", weighed about 220 pounds, was a fine specimen of American manhood. And he was a very courageous individual. In other words, he had lots of guts. He called me when he was next. They threw him in next to me in a room, and he bored a hole through the wall so he could talk to me. And it was 22 inches through brick and cement. But when I was able to talk to him, we talked about God. And at the time, I didn't know this, but he had planned, even though he had not been serving God when he became a prisoner, he had planned to return to be a minister. Well, Ron didn't make it. The Vietnamese kept him separate from everyone else, never gave him a roommate. He went through a lot of torture. They finally broke his will. And we don't know exactly what happened, except he died a prisoner. He gave his life for those things that he believed in so strongly. One day, Ron tapped on the wall and he said, "Robbie, I'm terribly blue." I said, "What's the matter, Ron?" And this is something we had all agreed to do. I'd put out the word that anytime you're down in the dumps, be sure and let somebody know. We had found that it was extremely important to let someone share your burden. Don't bear it by yourself. And so I'd put this policy out. So he called me and he said, "I'm really down in the dumps." And I said, "What's the matter?" And I've told this story many times, but it's still a good story. Maybe you'll enjoy it. Ron said, "I just realized that I have lost everything." I said, "What do you mean?" He had been a prisoner some 4 or 5 months already. And yet the realization had just hit him that he had lost everything. And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "They stripped me of all my clothes." Well, they did this to all of us. And I said, "Yes, I know." And he said, "They even took my underclothes." And I said, "Yes, I know that too." He said, "And they took my glasses. They took my ID card, my identification card. And they took my Geneva Conventions card that tells them how they're supposed to treat me." Of course, they disregarded this anyway. And I said, "Yes, I know that." And he said, "But worse than that, they took my identity." And he said, "You know, when I was out there, we always talked about freedom as out there. You know, we were in here. We talked about freedom and all the good things as out there." He said, "Out there, I was someone." He said, "I had a job, and it had its place. I was doing a job that they thought was fairly important. I belonged. I worked for a guy that I respected. And there were people who worked for me who respected me. I had a niche." And he said, "I was part of the community. My wife loves me. My children, they respect me, and they have faith in me. They know that I'm going to do them proud. I'm going to stay strong." And he said, "But here, I am nothing." He said, "They have even taken my name. They don't even call me by my name. You've given me a Vietnamese name that I don't even understand. I understood what he was saying. I'd gone through the same thing before that. And I said, Ron, do you believe the Bible? And he said, I sure do. Now, meanwhile, while we're talking like this, it's not quite so simple. There's a small hole through 22 inches of cement and brick, about the size of your little finger. And when I want to talk, I hit twice. And he puts his ear down, and I put my lips up, and I whisper. And then, if he wants to say yes, two taps means yes, one means no, three is I don't know, four means wait. And if he wants me to say it again, he hits a series of taps, and we had all these signals. Well, he's answering, and sometimes he's bumping the wall with the heel of his hand telling me I want to talk. So we're carrying on this conversation through this little hole, and I said, do you believe in the Bible? And he said, I sure do. And I said, do you remember in there where it says that Jesus is the Son of God? And he said, yes. And I said, and do you remember it says that we are heirs and joint heirs with Jesus Christ? And he said, yes. And I said, well, do you believe that God created the heavens and the earth and everything else? And he said, yes. And I said, that means then that all of North Vietnam and the camp and everything belongs to God, right? And he said, yes. And he was kind of starting to think about this. And I said, well, if we're heirs and joint heirs with Jesus Christ, that really belongs to us. And there was kind of a stunned silence. And then instead of answering, he just tapped me off. He gave me the signal, I'll be back later. And I couldn't hardly understand that. And when he came back later, he was a, you know, it finally hit him, I guess. And he came back and he was a little bit choked up. And he said, that was a wonderful thought. And then he told me, he said, you know, I had to giggle a while ago when the guard came in. And I said, why? He said, I just pretended I was loaning him the keys. I'm sure that a very dear friend of mine would not mind me using his name, Wes Sharman, a captain in my unit that was shot down prior to myself. About 2 weeks after I was captured, they sent me to another camp. And the camp had just recently been opened. It was extremely primitive. And Wes was down there in what we call Incorrigible Row. Wes was hard and tough. They called him Incorrigible. He was an outstanding officer and pilot and a tough resistor, one that you'd have been extremely proud of or been proud to have been associated with. Well, Wes was giving him nothing except name, rank, serial number, date of birth, which was prescribed by our fighting man's code of conduct. However, after we got a hole through the wall, I passed my steel rod that I'd pried out of the cement. It was reinforcement steel. And we pried this out. We made the hole through the wall. I passed it through, and it went from one end of the building to the other, and pretty soon the whole camp was like Swiss cheese. Well, the Vietnamese took them about 3 weeks to catch us, and they were extremely unhappy, and that started a real purge, which took me out of the camp, and I didn't come back for a year, and then I lasted only 30 days again, and I never got back. Well, when the word came, Ron Storrs, the man I just told you about, was next to us. They came in and caught him with two pieces of paper. One was a complete list of every prisoner in North Vietnam, and we had a pretty good system. Well, we didn't want them to know we knew all these, but it was probably less important than the other piece of paper. On this other piece of paper were 14 directives that I had put out, 14 policies, and told them some information I wouldn't have had them had at all. And the worst part about it is Ron had made a mistake and put my name on it. So I was pretty well marked. Well, when they got the two pieces of paper from Ron, he grabbed one of them, and while they were trying to get it away from him, he held them off and ate it. Well, they were cutting him with a bayonet, and they were trying to knock him down, and they ran to get some more guards, and when they did, he gave me the emergency signal on the wall, and I pulled the plug out. And he said, if you got anything to get rid of, get rid of it. They found everything. So I quick went over and we started chunking rocks and bones and everything in these holes to try to stop them up. I sent word on down the other way and gave them the information. The word came back, if they find the hole, what do we tell them? Shall I lie to them? Now, this was from Wes Sharman. And Wes wanted to know, should we lie? Well, it really had me in a fix. You know, I didn't want to lie. I knew it was wrong to lie, but here, this is our enemy. They're torturing us, and they're forcing us to sign false statements. They're making us lie. So, you know, he caught me in such a tight
I didn't know what to say, and I said, don't tell him anything. That was my way out. I just said, don't tell him anything. Well, that's what happened. Wes told him nothing. He went through some very severe torture. It was just a couple of weeks prior to that when I arrived in the camp, and we called it the zoo, that this was the situation. They brought us in at night. They put me in this room and locked the door, and it was black, absolutely black, no light. I couldn't find, you know, there was nothing in there. But there was cement covered with a deep layer of dust, maybe a half an inch of dirt, I guess 25 or 30 years out. And there was no place to hang your mosquito net, so the mosquitoes had a feast on me that night, despite the fact I was wrapped in it. Well, the next day I got a little light coming under the wall. We had bent under the front wall and under the back wall, and that's where our light came through. By inverting myself and putting my head down in there, I could talk, I could whisper to someone. I didn't know where they were, but the acoustics were very strange, and I couldn't communicate with someone. And the first voice I heard was from a man that I thought, that everyone thought was dead. His wing had been shot off at 200 feet, and his wingman had seen his airplane, plus his leader had seen his airplane, flash and then crash in flames. And so they'd sent word out, you know, that he was dead. Well, just a week before I was captured, the Pentagon sent a message and said, do you have any reason to think this man's alive? And I said, please don't count him dead until you have definite proof because of his family. Well, the first person I talked to was this guy. He hadn't even been wounded. His chute had opened, and all the fire and everything, they hadn't seen his chute. So he had been a prisoner several months, and I was fairly new. And I said, hey, what's the first thing I do? I'm a senior officer. What's the first thing for me? And I was seeking some information. He said, well, try to get some of the things we need. And I said, well, it looks to me like the first things is to get a light in here. You know, it's totally black. And in the daytime, it was, you couldn't see anything hardly except maybe your hand. We need some light. We need a bed. We're sleeping on this in the dirt. We need a bed. We need to get outside to exercise. And we need a broom. And he said, boy, you got it. And I said, well, how do I go about it? And he said, ask the guard for a piece of, for a pencil and paper. And I said, I can't talk Vietnamese. And he said, pantomime it, man. So when the guard came in, I pantomimed it, and I got a pencil and paper. And I wrote a little note to the camp commander and told him I was a senior officer, and according to the Geneva Conventions, I was representing the other men, and I wanted to see him. He thought I wanted to come over and give him some information, I guess, so I got to see him right away, and when I got over there, he said, now, what do you want? So I told him we were living like pigs. I said, we don't even treat our animals as bad as you're treating us. And I thought we'd be treated as prisoners of war. I mean, this is what I thought. I made my demands, a broom, some light. Oh, and we were washing every fourth day. You know, we were filthy living in that dirt. And the broom, the light, the outside exercise, a bed. And he was furious, and so he had me thrown out and thrown back in the cell. And he said, remember, you're a criminal. So we were to find this out. We were treated as criminals until we were released. We were called criminals. And there was a period of time during which we could not refer to each other as anything but criminals or be tortured. They wanted us to think of ourselves as criminals, and they tried to force us to act like criminals so that we would depart from our military law and the code of conduct and all the rest. Well, before I went over to talk to him about it, I'd contacted this fellow I was talking about, and I said, I have permission to see the camp commander. Now I want you to do something. And he said, okay. And I said, pass the word throughout the camp. I want you to pray for a broom, a bed, lights, and outside exercise. And there was a stunned silence. And then he said, how do you pray for a broom in Latin? He was a Catholic. Now, I have nothing against Catholics. Some of my dearest friends are Catholics, and they're just devout persons, Christians as you'll ever meet. And of course, I've learned a lot about Catholics since I came back, how the charismatic movement has transcended all of the barriers and so forth. But anyway, he said, okay, I'll do it. Despite the fact that he was somewhat astonished, he said he would. So after I came back, he had passed the word throughout the camp to pray for these things.
And I guess there was quite a lot of astonishment up and down the way. It was just a couple of days. In fact, the following day, they came and got me, and I went with them over to an old shed, and they opened it up, and we got some of the cobwebs out of the door and went inside, and there were a bunch of what we call bedboards. They're just wooden platforms about 30 inches wide and 6 feet long. And then I got a couple of sawhorses and laid them on top, and the guard helped me, and I carried it back. It was quite heavy, and I carried it back, and so I had a bed. And I could look through a small crack, and I could see other people going after beds. So we had a bed, and that was the first day. And then that afternoon, they took me out, and I got 15 minutes of exercise. And I could hear other people going out to get exercise. And about the middle of the week, I heard a lot of commotion, and then I heard this voice echoing from apparently from the ceiling, and it said, "And he said, let there be light, and there was light." And I thought, I wonder who said that. Well, it was this guy that I talked to, this Catholic boy. Well, I finally recognized whose voice it was, but I didn't know what he was saying it for. Well, it was about a couple of hours later, and I heard a scuffling on the wall, and then our ceilings were some 15 feet high. And there were, in the front wall and the back wall, there were three openings, 4 by 6 inches. This was our air, plus the vent under the wall. And through the vent dropped a light bulb. Well, about 30 minutes later, the light bulb came on. And I had light. And then I knew what this friend of mine had been talking about when he said, "Let there be light, and there was light." I was moved then down to another cell, and a Baptist lad was moved in next to me, and I was talking to him about God, and I said, a lot of people were sick. They had diarrhea and dysentery, and sickness was really running rampant. Hygiene was terrible. The sanitation was horrible. So I said, "We've just got to have some brooms, number one. We've got to have some medicine." And I said, "How's your faith?" And you know, he hadn't really been going to church for years. And his faith was typical. And I said, "How's your faith?" And I'm doing it. Well, I'm tapping through to him. Now, our primary means of communication was tapping through the wall. And the tap code we derived from the alphabet. It was just 5-letter squares, what it was. We deleted the letter K and used the letter C interchangeably with the letter K because phonetically it sounds the same. So we had A, B, C, D, E across the top, F, G, H, I, J across the second line, and so forth. And the last letter in the last line was Z. And the way we would we'd use it is we would go down and across. And so if we want to go down the second... if we wanted to go to the letter G, it was the second line down and the second letter across, and it would be like this. That was the letter G. If I wanted to tell them who I was, everyone knew everyone else's initials. I would just send them, and I've identified myself. That's RR for Robbie Reisner. So this is this is the way we talk. Of course, it took a long time, but you know, we had quite a bit of time, like 24 hours a day. It did fill a lot of space, and so we really weren't concerned about the rapidity of it. And I was tapping through to him, and I said, "How's your faith?" And he said, "Oh, so-so." I still remember that, and I knew what he meant. And I said, "Would you pass the word to the camp?" And it had to go through him to get out. "Pass the word to the camp to pray for a broom." And he didn't say anything. I said, "Will you do it?" He said, he gave me the... R, which was Roger, you know, there's a short way of saying okay. So he said, "Roger." And so he did this. Well, 2 days later, I went up to get my food, and we walked up about 40 or 50 yards, and from a big pot, they had put some soup into a bowl, and there was our loaf of bread. And I went up there to get my food, and laying over in a corner was a whole stack of new broom. So I got my new broom and took it back to my room. And as quick as I could, I got on the wall and I said, "How's your faith?" And there was a slight hesitation. He said, "High as a kite." Well, God was working, and I think he opened a lot of people's eyes. You know, we learned to talk about God in a way that you wouldn't have believed, because we are grown men. We've been knocking around the world a long time. You normally don't think of a hotshot fighter pilot as being a devout Christian. And I'm not saying that you cannot be. I'm just saying we normally don't give that impression, you know. They're on the go a lot, and they're gone a lot. They live a pretty fast life. They work hard and they play hard. Well, we learned how important God was, and we learned to talk about the things that were important. We learned to talk about patriotism in our country and the fact that communism used patriotism to motivate people to fight and how proud they were of their country. We were a little bit chagrined, and sometimes a great deal chagrined, that we had not talked more about our country, that we had not been more patriotic. Do you know, when I was shot down, it may not be true now, when I was shot down, I can recall how we avoided conversations involving patriotism. Maybe you can recall the same thing. We just didn't talk about patriotism. That's kind of taboo, you know. It's like talking about sex in public back then. Well, I felt badly about it, and so did they. We started talking about the things that were important, and we were no longer ashamed. And we talked about God. Every individual that came into Heartbreak Hotel, this was eight cells. Well, this is what we named every place, and this was very aptly named. This is one of the first places you came to, and believe me, it was Heartbreak. And this is the way it looked. When they finally threw you in there and took your blindfold off, your handcuffs, and you were turned loose, you looked around and surveyed what you had. And what you had, when you first were captured, you had no shoes. You normally had on some old peasant's clothes. They were cut off at the knees, probably. They were threadbare and patched. Maybe you had a grass mat and a blanket. Now, later on, we got two blankets. And you might or you might not have a water pot that held a pint of water and a porcelain cup. And you would have a two-gallon bucket, which was your waste bucket. That was your toilet. Your waste can for everything, and an old rusty one with a wooden top on it that was sitting there. When you looked around and surveyed what you had, it just wasn't very much, and everything was so dirty and filthy. 49 years of filth, germs, rats, mice, mosquitoes, spiders, and everything was contained there, and the walls were gray with age. And you looked on each, you stood in the middle of the room, you could almost touch each wall. It was 7 feet by 7 feet. And each side of you, as you came in the door and you looked directly ahead of you, there was nothing but a wall. On each side of you was a cement bunk. And in the middle, for walking space, was some 26 inches by 7 feet. And that was home. At the bottom of each of the bunks was a set of leg stocks built for the Vietnamese, whose ankles are quite small. There was iron upon iron. And you had two circles, a half circle here and a half circle here. And when this top iron was raised up, they stuck your ankles in there. And when they lowered it and locked it, you were there. You weren't going anyplace. Well, they used those extensively. And sometimes the holes were too small for our ankles. And of course, it took the hide off and some of the meat. And then when you would move, it would tear the scab off and it would bleed again. And then when you were still, it would form another scab. And the next time you would move, it would pull it off again. Well, this was your home. And then they had a vent. A drain. Oh, all the bunks were slanted down so that any fluids, if you threw up or if you couldn't get off your bunk to relieve yourself, that all ran to the foot of the bunk, and then it slanted off, it ran in the floor and then back down and ran out a small hole that we call our rat hole, because the rats used it more than anyone else. I heard someone say they had a southern exposure of rats and a cross ventilation of cockroaches. Well, that's about the extent of it. The cockroaches were about 3 inches long, and they were flying creatures. And there was no, you just couldn't keep them out. They would come through the tops of the windows, and they made a sound like a B-17. And at night, you know, you just couldn't sleep. The droning would go on, or a big blue bottle fly. It was a horrible noise. And then the mosquitoes, and this is an honest goodness fact, the mosquitoes would make so much noise that it sounded like a drone of airplanes. There would be hundreds of mosquitoes in your cell coming in through all the holes, and the only thing, and your net would be almost black with them. We did have a mosquito net. However, when they punished you, they'd take your mosquito net, and you had nothing, you know. And boy, they had a field day with us. Well, that was home. It was a very dismal home. This was Heartbreak Hotel. I've heard some very wonderful things. I've heard some very sad things from people that came in there. We, well, of course, were denied any communication. And if we were caught trying to communicate in any way, talk, tap, a note, or anything at all, then we were tortured for it. And when they did this, they used this for an excuse to really put the bite on us, because they wanted to break us and use us for propaganda. So I remember coming in there, and then as they cycled the new guys through, and some of them were quite young, we would tell them how to set up their nets, how to hang, some of them didn't know how to hang up a mosquito net. We'd tell them how to hang up the mosquito net, cap their dish one on the other to keep the rats out, and tell them to save any bread they had left over for us. We were so very hungry, and it just wasn't enough to keep us going. Sometimes the soup would be a soup bowl about so big and about so deep, and you could see the bottom. There would be no sediment in it. Whatever was cooked in it was gone. And then we'd have this hunk of bread, and it just wasn't enough. And until 1967, we just existed. Well, we used to tell them this, and then the next thing we would tell them, or we'd ask them, if they were a Christian. Now, I wasn't alone in this. My very, very dear friend was a Navy commander. He's now an admiral. And he would alternate with me. And we'd talk to them about God and tell them, and one of the things we'd ask them if they knew how to pray. And they said, no, we'd tell them they better learn because they're going to need it. So we weren't ashamed to talk about God. We knew the importance of it, and we told them right away that they were going to need God. Now, as I came out on the bus, after we were, during the process of freeing us, we came out of Hanoi to the Jalam Airport. We were on a bus, and the seats were quite high, I remember, and quite close to the wall. I was sitting near the window, and someone whispered through the crack and said, hey, Colonel, do you remember the first day I came in? And I didn't recognize the voice, and I turned and looked through the crack to see who it was, and I recognized him. And I said, yeah, I remember. He said, I came into Heartbreak Hotel. And I said, yeah, I remember. It'd been years and years ago. He said, do you remember the first thing you said to me? And I said, no, I can't. He said, you asked me if I knew how to pray. And he said, at the time, I didn't. He said, I really understand now. He said, I know how to pray. Well, God did a lot of wonderful things over there. When I arrived, their policy was no torture when I first arrived. It just harassed you and threatened you. And I remember they ran through their repertoire frequently about what they were going to do to me because, and it wasn't just me. When I say me, I'm using myself only as an example. So they said, do you remember what happened to Mussolini? And I said, yeah. I said, he was hung upside down. And how would you like to be hung upside down? And I said, I don't think I'd like that much. And they said, well, that's what we're going to do to you unless you talk. The first day I ran through 14 interrogators. Now, some of them could speak English, some used interpreters. One of them was a woman. She said, you want to see your family again? I said, yes. I expect to see them again, she said. If you don't talk, if you don't give us the information we want, you'll never see your wife and family. And so they tried all these things. They said they were going to burn me at the stake, they were going to execute me and so forth. And one of their favorites, and it was a little awesome, was they're going to turn me back over to the people where I was captured because I had killed a lot of them and so forth, they said. And blood would be paid in blood. They were always saying this. And of course, there was the threat of trial and execution as war criminal. They played that one heavily. Then there was a march through Hanoi. We called it the Hanoi Parade. And that was no ball. They beat us. They almost took us away from the guards. They hit us with bottles. And one of the most awesome sounds I ever heard in all my life was a crowd out of control turned into animals trying to get at you. And it's a terrible sound. The Vietnamese agitated them with sound trucks as we went along the streets through Hanoi, marching two by two, handcuffed together with a guard behind us, two guards behind us with fixed bayonets. And they did such a good job, the people got out of control, and then they could hardly keep us from them. Well, God was very much on the scene. The first 10 weeks, they were not allowed to torture us. And then when they found those holes out at the zoo, that started it, and they found the other incriminating evidence that I was doing some things in camp, and they said, the camp commander said, and he was very dramatic, he said, so you try to take over my camp, and he always used his finger like this, and I said, no, I'm not trying to take over your camp. He said, I am the camp commander, and he had some other things to say, and so they handcuffed me, my hands behind me, and they told me to open my mouth, and I wasn't about to open my mouth, so they opened it for me. And then they stuffed newspapers down.
And I had a bad cold, I still remember. And as they stuck this newspaper down, I started choking and I couldn't get my breath. And I really was scared for a little bit because I thought I was going to choke to death. And then I got to thinking, you know, dying is dying is dying, you know. But, you know, I hadn't been afraid of being shot down and killed. I hadn't been afraid they were going to execute me. You know, it wouldn't have been anything unique. But here I was, for a moment, I was scared I was going to die. And I thought, well, that's kind of silly. You're going to be you're choking to death, but you just, you know, you pass through all these other things. And so when I finally got over that, I thought, no, you're not going to die. God's not going to let you choke. Well, I went through some trying moments until they threw me in the back of a truck, hauled me back down to Hanoi Hilton, as we dubbed the prison. And I've made my apologies to Mr. Hilton. I'm sure he doesn't mind. The place was Wallow Prison in the heart of Hanoi, and it's a very infamous place. Compares favorably to Devil's Island. Anyway, he took me back, put me in twin leg stocks, and then they started interrogating me, and they would keep me up all times of the day and night. But they still had not started torturing. And I'm talking about really putting the bite on you. And a certain amount of harassment was going on. I got no shave or haircut. And they had shaved my head just before that so that my beard and my hair grew at the same time. And it was pretty weird looking, I'm sure. My beard was just the same length as my hair. And they used to bring their little kids, and I guess to scare them, I don't know, hold them up to this vent. And I'm talking about 2-year-old and 3-year-old. And they'd take their fists and shake them at me, and the little kids would go, shh, shh, like they would to an animal. And I'm telling you, it just broke my heart to see them putting hate in these little kids. I just left my own children, and it really just broke me up. I used to just cry about it. But anyway, they really treated us like animals, but they still hadn't started torturing us. Now, they would deprive us of food for days and water for days at a time, and would let me live in my own filth because they wouldn't let me off of the bunk. And it was miserably cold. I was sleeping on cement. I had one suit of pajama-like peasant's clothes, one blanket, one grass mat, and it was in November and December, and it was cold, and I shivered like a dog. Well, the first day they locked me up was really bad because I'm a very active person, and you never know. You know, you can sit here and think about it. Now, my legs are locked tight, see, but I can sit up, or I can lay flat down on my back, but I can't go anyplace, and there's nothing in there. And the guard gives me a piece of bread to eat, and then he takes my water and sits it on the other bunk, and I just stare at it, you know. Well, it was just harassment, but still it was real tough on me because I just never had been locked down like that. I'd always been able to exercise, and I'd always been very active, doing something. So I really had to pray. I thought, this is really tougher than I anticipated, you know. I never imagined it would be so bad just to be inactive. So the first day there was a speaker right outside my window, a radio speaker, and we call them liar's boxes because that's where all the propaganda comes through. And the thing went with Vietnamese music. This was not one designed for Americans because I was isolated in what was called Nugai Village. And I was in with the Vietnamese. There were Vietnamese in the other cell blocks. Now, we're in solid cells. They couldn't talk to me. I couldn't see them. I couldn't talk to them. But I'm in with Vietnamese, no Americans around. This radio would go for the Vietnamese, and it's feeding them propaganda and this weird music. You know that you've heard it. It goes up and down, the notes are all fouled up, you know. Well, it was so discordant, you know, it was like a shock at first, and then it was like sheer torture. And I said, Lord, I can't stand this very long. Well, it lasted until 9:30 at night, and boy, what a relief that was. And then the next morning it started at 5 o'clock, and they start off by giving this Mo-ta-ba-bon-nam-south, and they're counting off cadence. Everybody in the country gets up at 5 and takes exercise, see? Well, the man would go through these different exercises in a different tempo, and then a woman would take over. And I grew to hate that. You know, I hate very few things in the world, and I don't hate anyone, but I grew to hate that song. It just got to me. And this would play for a while, and then throughout the day we'd have this weird music and these sing-song words. And so by the end of the second day, I was really, my nerves were coming unglued. So I was praying pretty hard. And the third morning when it started, I just thought I was going to start screaming. So I really started praying hard. And I said, Lord, you know I can't stand any more of this. And you just got to do something about it. And I prayed just as hard as I was capable of. And while I was praying, the radio stopped. And I thought, oh, I hope it's going off. You know, I was afraid to hope too much. My faith wasn't quite that strong. So it didn't come back on for a minute, and the guards who were above me, that slept above me in the barracks, came down, and they got a ladder, and they went up to the speaker, and it was suspended high up on the wall, always loud enough that you could hear it for at least two blocks, because there was only one every two blocks, I think. And it was terribly loud. Well, they got up, and they hammered on the box, and I could hear the static and go, quick, quick, quick. And I thought, oh, Lord, don't let it start again. And they beat on this thing, but they never could get it started. The radio never came back on as long as I was in stocks. Well, after I had been in stocks some 28 days, somebody was washing my dish, and I knew it. And I suspected it was another American. So one day when I lost complete control of my body functions, they brought me some green. It looked like grass in a dish cooked into a soup. And I ate this with an aluminum spoon, a scoop, and on the bottom of my dish. Now, the guard had never looked at my dish. I'd had this a couple of times before when I lost control of my body functions. And I started to call him a veterinarian. I'm sure he wasn't that good. But the medic would come in, and he would tell him to give me something else, you know, to keep me from getting too sick. Anyway, I wrote on the bottom of my plate, Reisner, 28 days in stocks, okay. And I just knew some American would wash my dish and he would see it. And it was so important to me for them to know I was over there, just for some strange reason. I just wanted somebody to know where I was. But the guard came in after my dish, and the first thing he did was look in the bottom, and I wanted to make sure that guy would read it. So on the bottom, inside the dish, I'd written bottom. The guard looked at that and turned it over, and there it was. He had never done it before, and then he caught me. So no more food. And even after that, they would give me no scoop, so I ate with two bamboo sticks, you know, like chopsticks. But anyway, on the 2nd of December, about nightfall, they came in and they started to work on me. And this, they had changed the policy. They were going to start torturing. And I guess I was the first customer. And they took pads about this thick and about this big around, put them over my eyes, and then bound them with some binding and just forced them right into the eye sockets. And it was extremely painful. Then they started working on my arms, and two men can bind your arms tight enough with ropes that they can squeeze the blood through the pores. And in winding these arms, they bound them individually and then bound them together. And I remember one of them slapping them when he got through, and it was just as solid as one big piece of frozen meat. Now, you know what that's like. Well, they wound me up clear up under my armpits behind me, and they pulled this one out, this one partially out, and separated my ribs. And then they went to work on my leg. Now, I don't tell you this to tell you that I had it so bad over there. A lot of people were tortured. But this gives you an idea of how they went about getting information or forcing us to acquiesce to their will. They used it frequently. I've heard as many as four men screaming at one time, and grown men, they have to hurt them pretty bad to get them to scream. I've heard some things that made me very, very proud to be an American. If I needed anything to make me any prouder, I heard a guy, and they used to torture right next to me. They put me in there, I guess, on purpose. And I was right in the area where they did all the torturing, and I heard a guy scream. And then I heard him say, "Don't twist that leg, the bone's sticking out." And then I heard the iron. They had an iron on his other leg, and it's a jumbo bar about 15 feet long, about this big around. It weighs a lot of pounds. And they put a clevis pin on your ankle like this with the eyes in front, and they stick the bar through it. The weight of it rests on your ankle, and the pain, there's some nerves right around your ankle. It just, every time you move, it just sneaks down a little further, and the pressure becomes greater, and the pain just crawls up your leg like a snake, and it eats right into your heart almost. Well, they had this on him too, and they would rattle this thing, and he would groan. And then I heard him say, "If you will talk," this is the Vietnamese interrogator, "if you will talk, you will be treated leniently and humanely. And if you do not, you'll be severely punished." And I heard this guy say, and he'd just been hurt bad. He'd bailed out, and he had this bone sticking out, and they'd been really on him. He said, "If that's all you got to offer, let's get on with it." Now, wouldn't that make you proud? Well, they got on with it. And I could hear all this going on, and he did talk. Well, I'm getting a little ahead of myself. I'm in the stocks. They came after me. They started working on me. And through the night, the pain bit into me, and I had pain that I never dreamed was possible. And I always thought of myself as a very strong person. You know, I like to imagine anyway that I was as good as those people I read about in the Blue Book and the Argosy and, you know, these men's magazines that were tortured to death but never said a word. Well, I thought this was possible. But you see, the Vietnamese never intended to kill us. They only intended to use us. And so as the night wore on and the pain got worse, and I couldn't stand it, and I was praying, and I believed that God would give me the grace to be tortured to death before I would talk. I knew I could not give anything but name, rank, serial number, and date of birth, according to the Fighting Man's Code. Well, the night wore on. I didn't know what I was going to do, and I kept saying, God, you said your grace was sufficient. But I kind of had it wrong. I had it twisted. I thought, you know, I interpreted it wrong. Well, that wasn't God's plan. So sometime during the night, I thought I would be able to pass out from the pain, but I could never go completely out. But I could hear somebody else screaming in the distance. And sometimes then I would come closer to consciousness. And I would realize it was me. Now, some of you may have passed out in the past. You know how things get way off? You can hear people talking way off in the distance like that when you start to pass out. Well, that's the way I could hear this guy screaming off in the distance, and it would come back to me. Well, I was somewhat ashamed to be screaming, I'll tell you. I never thought they would ever torture me into screaming. But I screamed a lot, a long time. And they used to come in, and then they would come in and tell me to be silent. And they would knock me down. Well, I tried to knock myself out, and all I did was mash my nose and cut my head. And they caught me and tied me to a post. And then I just suffered a while. Well, before morning, I was ready to talk. And I despised myself. I never was so ashamed in all my life of anyone as myself. I was, well, I can't express it. So they said, okay, you ready to talk? And I said, yes. They said, okay, here's the questions. Where'd you fly from? And I said, untie my arms. I can't talk till you untie my arms. I was trying to bargain for a little bit of relief. Well, I argued with them for a little bit, and they finally loosened my arms enough that I would talk. I gave them the information they wanted was where I flew from and what kind of airplane I was flying from. And then they made me sign a statement saying that I had penetrated the sovereign airspace of the sovereign socialist country of North Vietnam, and on and on and on. And I apologized to the North Vietnamese people, and I signed this. Well, I was lower than a snake's belly. I remember that morning, however, I was praying, and I had not prayed until this time, Lord, get me out of these stocks, or anything else. I was miserable. I was hungry, I was weak, and I was cold. But I had not prayed for a change in status, because I figured the Lord had let me be put there in the first place. And I used to say, well, Lord, when you're ready to take me up, I'm more than willing, you know, I'm ready to go anytime. But I felt that I shouldn't pray that way until the 2nd of December. But that morning when I started to pray, and I always prayed in the morning, I would pray for my family and my relatives all morning from 5 o'clock until noon. And then from noon on, I'd pray for all the guys in the prison that I knew, plus everybody I'd ever met. You know, I could pray, you know, 18 hours. You can pray about a lot of people. Well, this is the way I spent my day. And that morning I started to pray, and I felt something stop me. I was praying for one of my family, and I stopped. And it was just as though it was so strong that I knew I was supposed to pray to get out of stocks, and I couldn't believe it. And I said, just like I'm talking now, I said, Lord, you want me to pray to get out of stocks? And that feeling again. And I said, Lord, are you sure? And, you know, I didn't want to pray any way that God didn't want me to pray. I was doing my level best to be the kind of guy that he wanted me to be. And I said, are you sure? And that feeling just got stronger. And I said, all right, Lord, I guess I have been here long enough. And I said, okay, Lord. And I learned to talk to Jesus like I'm talking to you. Not of disrespect, but because I talk to him so much, you know. When you talk to someone 18 hours a day, you get pretty familiar with them. You know what I mean? So I said, Jesus, or Lord, I guess I said, I'm asking you for more clothes, for another blanket, for some more food, for some food, and to get out of these stocks. And as soon as I said it, the burden lifted, and I heard the answers on the way. I didn't pray another breath about my situation, but I continued praying through the day, and that night's when they came and got me about dark and worked me over during the night. The next morning at 5:10, the gong goes off at 5:00, and it's one of these symbol-type gongs they use for time. And the gong went off at 5:00, but before the gong went off, I had 10 minutes of blissful sleep with my knees right up under my chin. I hadn't been able to get my knees up for 32 days, and I laid down on that old hard bunk and slept like a baby for about 10 minutes. The gong went off, and I jumped up and started running in place, and the guard looked in to see what I was doing, and I guess he was somewhat amazed. I was so glad to be out of those stocks. And I was weak. I could almost fall, but I wanted to exercise, so I began to run in place. Well, about 8:30, he brought in a long sleeve, heavy sweatshirt, turtleneck sweatshirt, another set of these pajama-like prison garb, and an extra blanket. So now I had two blankets, some more clothes. At 9:30, he brought in my first ration. I'd asked God for food, more clothes, a blanket, and to get out of the stocks. I now was out of stocks. I had another blanket, more clothes, and I got my food. Well, you know, I didn't say, well, that's positive, proof positive. God heard me and he answered my prayer. I said, Lord, that's a tough way to get an answer. You know, he tortured me all night long. And I was still smarting, you know, and I said, well, I'll be very frank with you. I was kind of careful how I prayed after that. You know, I was kind of afraid to ask for anything for fear it was going to hurt so much. And, you know, some of the time I would say, I wanted to be just like God wanted me to be. That's what I wanted. And I'd say, Lord, keep me humble. And then I would have a thought, oh, I wonder what he's going to do to me to keep me humble. You know? Well, I know that the Lord must have smiled a lot of times at my prayers. But I remembered my mother used to say, pray within God's will. And I never really understood what she was talking about. Not really. But I learned, if I felt the slightest pull, the slightest foot dragging of the Spirit, well, I would stop praying about that, and I'd switch horses, you know? I began to feel God's presence so strongly, so intimately, that I was able to determine what I was supposed to pray about. It, you know, now I've never told some of these things ever before. I haven't even told some of these things to my family, but I feel I want to tell you. One day, I had a small piece of pencil, just that long, that I'd found, and it was really strictly verboten to have a pencil or a piece of lead or anything. A nail was enough to get you tortured. Anything in that cell that the guard didn't give you, that was a no-no. But I'd had this pencil, and I'd moved it from time to time. Every time I figured they were going to search a certain place, I'd move it. And they inspected our rooms with flashlights, and they probed in all the cracks, and they looked for anything. Well, I had shinnied up the wall, and they had a barred window that faced on a wall. I couldn't see anything. But way up there, higher than anyone could even reach, I had climbed up and placed this pencil with a little piece, a dab of soap, so it couldn't fall down, way over in a corner behind a ledge. This morning, I was praying, and I was walking back and forth, and I generally walk like this, and all of a sudden, I just as though someone just stopped me and turned, and I looked up at that window, and I felt the strangest premonition. And I, without any thought, I just walked up, climbed up this wall, and got up on the ledge, and reached up and got my pencil, took it back over and re-hit it, and within 10 minutes, two guys with a lighter climbed up on the outside to start boarding up my window, and they would have found my pencil just like that. It was just, you know, it seemed like I became sensitive enough that God could talk to me. Now, I know that many of you have experienced this. You know what I'm talking about. But it was new to me. I'd never been quite that close to God. But I learned also to pray within God's will. I didn't even want to pray for anything that God didn't want me to. One time when I was really being hurt, they had hurt me badly because they said I'd caused them to lose face in front of foreigners. I had hoped I had. But they were probably as mad as you can get them. You know, you can do a lot of things, but anytime they lose face, really lose face, in front of a Caucasian, That's about the worst you can do to them. Well, I'd done it to them. They were supposed to, they'd given me two pictures of my family before I was to meet. They had tortured me before I was to meet a foreign delegation. And they told me what I must say. Well, anyway, the foreign delegation asked to photograph the pictures that I had of my family. I just couldn't do that. I tore the pictures up and sunk them in my waste bucket. And they were furious. And I wouldn't tell them where the remains was until they tortured me twice more. And anyway, I was really suffering. And then they twisted my arms behind me, handcuffed me, and put me in twin leg stocks. And I couldn't lay down. I couldn't rest. Well, after 10 days and nights, I couldn't even think of the... I couldn't remember the names of my wife and children. I was gone. The handcuffs were on so tight. My arm had swollen up, and I had these red streaks running up and through to my shoulder. And it was huge. And I couldn't even bend my fingers over... I remember looking at it. I couldn't bend them over a quarter of an inch, and they had turned black. And I had five eruptions on my wrist around the handcuffs. And the only way they could close the handcuffs was take both hands and force it into the flesh until one of the ratchets caught. And my right arm was really bad. Well, that's the way they had me. And I was really suffering. On top of that, sometimes they would leave me, and they wouldn't let me out to relieve myself. And I had a kidney block. And I was suffering inside as well as outside. And I said, Lord, I just can't take anymore. You know, this is all I can take. And I said, don't you know that, Lord? And while I was praying, I fell backwards. And when I did, the right ratchet closed another notch, and it just pressed it right into the bone, you know. And I was really in pain. And as I got up, as I twisted over to get up, and I was just shaking like a dog, my right ratchet caught, or the edge of the handcuff caught on the edge of the bunk, which was very sharp. And as I got up, I looked back, and I saw that sharp edge, and without any conscious thought, I just reached back and hooked my handcuff, one of the ratchets, the corner of it, on the edge of the bunk and gave a mighty jerk, and the handcuff came off. And I said, oh, Lord, thank you. And I said, now, and my legs were in stocks, and on the end of this was a huge, big old rusty lock. It must have been that big. I said, Lord, I've got to get out of these stocks to relieve myself. I'm dying. And I just reached over and pulled this old big lock, and it came open. I opened the stocks. I got out, and I relieved myself. I got back in, put my legs in, and snapped the lock, and put my hands behind me. One other time, when I was really desperate, I was able to unlock that lock, my handcuff, rather, and I tried many, many other times. I finally pulled all the corners off my bunk in the cement, and couldn't get it open. But God knows when you've had enough. You know, he said he wouldn't make us suffer any more than was necessary. And I used to think, Lord, I must be the most terrible, hard-headed guy in the world if I have to suffer like this. And I used to say, Lord, how long is this going to take? No, I believed that I was there. I still believe that I was there to learn. I was there to learn to be obedient. I was there to learn faith. But I used to say, Lord, I've been here for several years, and haven't I learned enough yet? I wanted out so desperately bad. I was so terribly, terribly lonesome. I lived by myself for more than 4 years, 54 months. And they isolated me from the other prisoners because they said I was an incorrigible troublemaker. I was a revolutionary. It wasn't a bad term, was it? But they took me away from the other prisoners and put me by myself. And they said, everywhere we put you, there's trouble. There's resistance. And you'll never see another American prisoner. And I believed them. And that made it all the worse because I knew my fate was a bare 7-foot cell until the end of the war. And I didn't know how long that was going to be. And that was a hard thing to bear because I didn't know how long it was going to last. It was just like the torture. If they'd have said, we're going to torture you for 10 minutes, he said, okay, get on with it. I'm going to torture you for 30 minutes. You'd say, oh, that's a long time, but I can hack it, I guess. But they never tell you how long, see. Sometimes they put you in a, just put you against the wall and make you hold your hands up. You know, after 24 hours, that gets pretty tiresome, too. Or they put you on your knees. Sometimes you want to see how painful something simple can be. Get out on your knees on a cement floor. Put your arms behind you and just get on your knees at attention and sit there for a while. Now, you can't lean back. You got to stand right on your knee bones. A lot of the guys were on their knees until the bare bone came through. And they used all sorts of little tricks like that. They put you even on a stool, and they wouldn't let you go to sleep. You just sat on the stool. And if you fell off, they'd come in and hammer you with their fist or the gun butt, and they'd put you back up there. And after about 8 or 10 days, you know, you saw all sorts of strange sights and heard all sorts of strange sounds. You know, hallucinations were really something. But they finally would just wear you down until your will went. But they had all sorts of cute little tricks, but their favorite one was the rope trick, where they would tie your arms behind you, sit you down, lean you forward, run a rope from where your arms had been bound behind you, across your shoulder, and then around your feet, which were crossed like this, around your feet, back up over the shoulder, and then through the ropes that were where your arms were bound. Then they would put their knees in the back, in your back, between your shoulder blades, and they would bounce up and down on you. And every time they would bounce, they'd take slack up. And boy, they would get you down just like a good-sized pretzel. And you couldn't get your breath, and everything was screaming in agony, you know. Well, this is their favorite. They use this one most frequently. And I don't know anyone that was able to just stay with it and refuse. Eventually, everyone that I know of finally gave in enough to say, okay, I'll do it. Whether they did or not, they lied, cheated, and everything else they could. But that was their favorite trick. And they had iron bars, and they used in various and sundry places across your abdomen, across your throat, and an iron bar with rags wrapped around it about this big around. They put it in your mouth and then put a rope around from this side, or a piece of rag, and then make a tourniquet, and then just turn it up, you know, and they pull it back like a bridle bit. But they did all of these things, first of all, to extract military information. This was in the first day or two of capture. And after that, only to extract propaganda. Well, and things were desperate. There were times when I didn't know if I was going to hack it. I know that there were other people. I think that there were some that committed suicide because they couldn't. They wanted to deny the Vietnamese any more propaganda value. And they knew, or they felt, that it was better to die than to give the Vietnamese anything. I know that people gave their lives in this fashion. And the Vietnamese, I believe, tortured some to death, probably by mistake. I think they didn't intend to kill us. They wanted to use us. At any rate, I saw God do some wonderful things. Now, I want to tell you one more thing. And I asked how long I was to speak, and I should cut my comments right down to the bare minimum, because John said curfew was at 11. I wanted to tell you why I'm here tonight. I wouldn't be here if I didn't know that God is God. I wouldn't be here if I were not a Christian, and if I didn't know what Christianity is, if I didn't believe the Bible was true. In other words, if I didn't believe all these things, I wouldn't be here tonight. I'm a fairly realistic person. I deal in realism. I'm fairly objective. I try to steer clear of subjectivism. And so, when I tell you tonight that I'm here because there is a God, I know what I'm talking about. When I was in prison, now there's a lot of wonderful stories I could tell you, and you'll just have to take my word for it when I tell you that I asked God to show me that He was in such a way that I can never, ever die. Now, I had been a Christian. I grew up in Assembly of God Church. I'd seen miracles performed. I'd been healed. I'd seen my own folks healed. And yet there was still room for doubt. Isn't that strange? Maybe I did have to go to prison for 7.5 years for God to get rid of that. But at any rate, I said, God, I can't afford to have any doubts. When I get out of here, I would like to be able to stand up when you give me the opportunity to talk about you or the Bible or heaven. I would like to be able to talk from factual information. I said, everybody, anybody that wants to can talk about faith, because faith is unseen, it's unfelt, it's only down here. You can't touch it and you can't eat it. I said, Lord, faith is wonderful. You can live on it unless the chips are really down. You've got to, I want something more. That's what I said. I want to know for absolutely sure, so that when I tell somebody that God is, that Jesus is, that you hear and answer prayer, I want to know that I'm telling the truth. I don't want to go on hearsay. I don't want it secondhand. I don't want it from the Bible. I don't want it from a minister. I want it from you. I know that God understood. I was sincere. God set about to show me. Now, I said I'd seen miracles. I saw a little girl's leg grow 8 inches in front of my eyes. I've seen God perform miracles, and yet there was still an element of doubt. And so God set about to erase all that doubt, so that as he knew that someday I would be standing right here talking to you. And he wanted me to be able to say this, and I'm going to say it. I know that God is just as strong as I know that the scientific law of gravity exists. God is. So when I say that I'm a Christian, I serve a risen Savior, and God hears and answers prayer, when I say that I believe, that I know that God can run your life and my life in perfection, that if you're willing, he can take hold and do all things for you, if you're willing to let this happen. I know this to be a fact. So, I'm not a minister, I'm not a preacher. I'm merely here tonight because I serve the same person as you do. I wanted to tell you that God operates every place, especially in tough places. That's where God really shines. So when the chips are down, when you really need someone to help you, when there's nobody, you see, when I was in that cell, I finally realized there's not anybody, not even the President of the United States, my Commander-in-Chief, could reach his hand into that cell and give me any aid. There was no comfort, no solace from any source, except God. And you know, they weren't able ever to shut me up tight enough. And I was in a dark room for 10 months. And I got my air through the crack under the door. They were never able to shut me up tight enough that God couldn't get in. Do you remember the old song about telephone to Jesus or God's royal telephone? Man, I really kept that line on. And that's true. You know, God was never, ever busy. I never got a busy signal the whole time. He was never gone. He never took a vacation. He was somebody that I depended on day and night. I would wake up at 2 a.m. and my very first thought and my very first word was to God. I needed him that desperately. And he never, ever failed me. He hasn't failed me since then. And of course, he never will. Isn't it good to know that we are living in reality? We don't have to depend on mythology, on a figment of our imagination, but what we have is real. I believe that God can do all things. I believe that in God, despite our own limitations, our own human frailties, our own inadequacies, that God is able to use any one of us in any capacity that he so desires. I believe that. I believe if he wants to pick a man right out of the crowd and make him President of the United States, if that guy can't even read and write, he can do it. I believe that. I put above my bunk, an inch deep in the wall, all things are possible if you only believe, and I believe that. Someone, when we were freed, said, did you ever live in room 6 in heartbreak? And I said, yes. He said, did you write something above your bunk? And I said, yes, and I repeated it, and he said, I stood over on the other side and looked through a hole one day on the other side, and he said, the guard opened the door and said, all I could see was all things are possible if you only believe. I still believe that. Isn't it wonderful? I thank you for inviting me to come and talk today. It's a real pleasure. It's such a thrill to talk to young people. I know that all are not young people that are here in age, but we're all young in heart, aren't we? But especially it thrills my heart to talk to young people because I know that you've got so much in front of you. You're the people that are going to take over here one day in the United States. There are so many souls that are dependent on you. One other thing, and then I'm going to stop. I promise, John. The little Vietnamese guard that cooked was almost an imbecile. He was just so ignorant, and he was so dumb. He had this look in his eyes like, I don't know if you ever noticed it, but I was raised on a farm, a bull. You know, they're not very smart. They've got this look, and everything they don't understand, they're suspicious of it, you know. Well, everything that he didn't understand, it was wrong. That's the way it was. And although he was a terrible trial, I remember he would lock us up. Sometimes he'd put our legs in stock and then lock the door, and he'd go away whistling. He was blissfully and ignorantly happy, you know. And for a while, we all envied him because to us, he was free. And then one day, someone, a young, one of the Lieutenant J.G. said, you know, I used to envy that guy. And he said, you know, the thing that I have in my heart, he was so terribly alone. He said, I'd like to go back and let all the animals out of the zoo. You know, he wanted to see the animals freed. But he said, you know, I used to envy this guy so much because he was free. And he said, I realize that it's not him that is free. It's us. We're free. He said, I'm locked up in stocks, but my soul is free. My spirit's free. And he said, we were born free men, and we'll die free men. We were born Americans, the land of the free and the home of the brave. And he said, I don't envy him anymore. Someday, and I've said this, someday we will return to freedom that they will never know. Isn't it wonderful to not only live in the land of the free and the home of the brave, but to be free down here? God bless you.
Though I've heard Robbie speak many times, I still stand awed at the realization of how great God is and how strong His power is to reach out and touch our lives, and how loving our Father is. Some of you may have been fighting some battles in your own lives, some decisions to make, or you've reached places in your lives where you haven't been able to say, yes, Lord, not my will, but thine be done. I want you right where you sit to reach out to the Lord. You're not confined in a cell, in leg stocks on a concrete bunk, but in the comfort of beautiful chapel, will you reach out to that same God that stood inside of a concrete cell and say, here's my life. I willingly give. While our musician plays, would you just reach out to him in love? And if you need to surrender afresh and anew tonight, would you do it right now? Oh God. Jesus.